Let's start with our motivation. And again, seeing this opportunity we have as something very precious, let's make good use of it. And so let's try and follow the instructions that we receive. Let's take them in, contemplate them, put them into practice. Not just saying, well, I don't like that one, or I feel like doing it this way, or whatever. But really trying to take the instructions of the great masters to heart and apply them to our own mind in a gentle but also firm way. And so in particular, let's take to heart the instructions on bodhicitta, on opening our hearts to each and every living being, and in doing so, also subduing our own self-centered thought. That self-centered thought that makes us resistant, makes us rebellious, makes us unaware of our own behavior, or even if we are aware of it, not caring what it's like, not caring about the effects of our actions on others. So let's see that self-centered thought as our real enemy. And when it raises its ugly head, instead of welcoming it into our mind, knowing it for what it is, and letting it go, not following its dictates, and instead really thinking of what is best for all living beings in this situation, and especially what's best for all living beings in the long term. So with that kind of motivation, let's listen to the Dharma this evening, with our ultimate aim being to attain full Buddhahood for the benefit of each and every living being. Okay, so we've been going through Aryadeva's 400 stanzas, and we are on chapter 6, which is called Abandoning Afflictions, and this is in the general section of the Bodhisattva practices. So we have to abandon the afflictions if we're going to do the Bodhisattva practices. We can't cherish our afflictions and at the same time work to become enlightened for the benefit of all beings. Those two things don't go together. So this is the chapter about abandoning afflictions. And in particular, until now in this chapter, Aryadeva's been really looking at the three main afflictions, confusion, or also which it means ignorance, and then clinging attachment, and then anger. Okay? So last time we were talking about how the three build on each other, and we were also talking about how a teacher guides people specifically according to whichever one of those three afflictions is the strongest, so that the instructions aren't necessarily the same for everybody, but according to people's dispositions, they're going to have different instructions, and they'll be treated differently too. So really emphasizing the uselessness and of comparing ourselves to others. And it's not just useless, but it also tangles us up in knots and makes us have all sorts of, makes us more confused, basically. Okay, so now we're on verse 131. And so this is talking about how to apply the antidotes And in order to apply the antidotes, it's very helpful to know the sequence in which those three principal afflictions or the three poisons arise. So Aryadeva says, first there is confusion, in the middle there is anger, and later there is desire, in three stages during the day. Okay? So we should apply the antidotes with an awareness of what affliction is more likely to arise and what period of the day, so we can be prepared for that affliction and know what to do about it. Okay? So at night, sleep and lethargy take over. So, and in the morning, that's because the element of phlegm dominates then. But so when we first wake up in the morning, we have the residual effect of sleep and lethargy. And so there's confusion or there's ignorance. That's what's, in the mind first thing when we wake up in the morning. Okay? Then, in the middle of the day, we go to work or we get active, and we start doing things. So, Aryadeva says, or actually Gelsabje says, we ride the wheel of dukkha. Okay, ride the roller coaster of dukkha. Okay, caused by the frustration of trying to make a living and trying to get what we want and get away from what we don't want. And so anger arises during the day when we're active and we're doing things and we're earning our living. Okay, so just think about your life. Is it true when you first wake up in the morning, kind of confusion, ignorance? Then you start working with other people, you get irritated, you get angry, you get annoyed, you get frustrated. Okay? Then, after you've worked all day, then, when it stops, you're kind of tired, you want to relax. So, desire arises. I want to sit and be entertained. Maybe you go home and what movie's on? What can I, look through the channels, go through the web? What can I do? What's entertaining to me? You want to have good food. You want to have sex. You want to go out and have a good time. So a desire arises in the evening. Okay? Right or wrong? Yeah? Kind of the way it is, isn't it? Okay. So in that way, we see that thus associated with what's happening with the body and what we're doing, at different periods, then these three afflictions are going to arise successively. First ignorance, then anger, then attachment during the day. Okay? And so knowing that, then to be aware of what their antidotes are and be prepared during certain periods of the day to, apply those antidotes. Okay, then the next verse, verse 132, is how to abandon desire. And so desire is hard to recognize as something to discard, and so exertion is necessary to abandon it. Yeah, what do you think? Is desire easy to recognize? Mm-hmm. No. So, Aryadeva says, desire is no friend, but it seems like one, which is why you do not fear it. But shouldn't people particularly rid themselves of a harmful friend? Okay, so desire is not a friend. It's not something that benefits us. It poisons our mind. It makes us get involved in the 10 non-virtuous pathways of action. However, desire seems like a friend to ordinary beings. Okay? Why does it seem like a friend? Because when desire's in our mind, we're kind of happy. It's like, oh, I'm with this person, I feel really good. Oh, this movie's so good, this food is so good, taking a nice long walk, I'm going golfing, I'm going to play baseball, and whatever it is that you like to do, then when you're doing it, there's attachment arising, but You feel happy doing it, so you don't see attachment as a problem in our life. Yeah? In fact, we often feel quite good when there's attachment in the mind, and so attachment seems like a friend to us. Yeah? So we work all day to try and be near the things that we're attached to because we like them, we enjoy them. Yeah. Look what pretty things I have. You know, whatever it is, you know, that you like. We all like different things. Okay. So it's hard to actually recognize when attachment's there, because when things are going well in our life and we feel good, we don't see any problem. And so we don't recognize that an affliction is present. Okay? And yet, attachment can be there. And the way we know that attachment is there is that as soon as the circumstance changes, then we get unhappy and we get frustrated and angry and irritated. Okay? If the circumstance changes and you don't have what you want, you're okay. Then you weren't attached to it at the beginning, okay? But if you find that, you know, you're watching a movie and then somebody changes the channel or somebody, you know, calls you and you have to attend to something else and you're irritated about it, or you got some new clothes that you really like and then they got a tear, or somebody spills spaghetti sauce over them, or your car gets dented, or... You know, who knows what? Your computer gets stolen. You lose your smartphone. Oh, my God. Life comes to an end if you lose your smartphone. My goodness. Yeah. And so then you realize how attached you are to it. Yeah. Like when people come here for retreats and we say, you know, no phones, and, you know, please leave it in the office, they kind of look at us like we're saying, chop your hand off and give it to me. You know? So we get like that. So that's how we know we're attached to something, is when we can't have it, and then we're upset about it. Okay? So even though in the long-term attachment produces suffering, so it's not really a friend, in the short term, we like it. We enjoy it. Okay? Because it seems nice. It makes us happy. We're with the people we like, doing the things we like. Okay? And so thus we don't fear attachment. Yeah? So when we're, you know, we're looking at something on the web or watching TV and there's advertisements coming up and, you know, convincing us that we need this, that, and the other thing, and we start going, oh, yeah, that looks like a pretty interesting thing. Yeah, I should really get that, or I should go there. I should look like that. I should do that. Yeah. And these things, you know, these thoughts just come in our mind as a result of the media, and we just go right along with them. Yeah. So that's a function of attachment. And, it leads us down the path to confusion in our life. Because we spend most of our time trying to become what society is telling us we need to be in order to be happy. And we completely lose ourselves in the process of it. Okay, so Aryadeva says, but shouldn't people particularly rid themselves of a harmful friend? Yeah, so if you had a friend that was lying to you and cheating to you, in a way, that's worse than the enemy that's like negative right up to your face, because the one who's in your face, you know, you recognize it. But the sly one that's cheating you is very devious. So that's the way we need to regard desire or attachment, that sly one that's sneaking up and cheating us. Okay, then verse 133, having understood, this is about having understood the difference regarding the causes and conditions that make desire arise, then we should abandon desire. Yeah. So for each of these different afflictions, we have to understand what are its causes. What are the conditions that make it rise? What is its function? What's its function? What does it do when it's in our mind? Okay. What other things does it is it related to? What's the effect of letting this kind of affliction run rampant in our mind? So we need to do some really in-depth meditation, asking ourselves these questions, and then just observing our life, you know, just thinking about our life and how our life goes and identifying these things. So verse 133 says, desire arises from causes and also arises through circumstance. Desire arising through circumstance is easy to deal with, but not the other. Okay? So best is if we never give a desire a chance to arise. However, we're ordinary beings in the desire realm, so desire arises, and it usually arises in two ways. Okay? So the technical wording for it is some forms of desire arise from a cause of a similar type, created by repeated familiarity in the past. So a cause of a similar type means that this moment of the clock was caused by the previous moment of the clock. So it's a similar type. It's a similar type of object, which is caused by the previous moment. Okay, so that's what similar type is. So what's its meaning is that one moment of attachment or one moment of desire acts as the cause for the next moment. Or even if you don't have manifest desire at this time, there's the seed of desire in the mind. Okay, so you ate your when you're eating your chocolate cake, there's desire. You finish the chocolate cake, you know, you're now paying attention to something else. And so at that point, your desire is not manifest, but it goes into the form of a seed, the seed of desire or seed of attachment. Then, you know, something can happen again and desire becomes manifest. Okay? So that seed of desire, when they talk about desire rising due to cause, especially of a similar type, they're talking about either the previous moment of desire or the seed of desire that is connecting two moments of desire. So that's one way in which it arises. Or one that's the principal cause of desire arising, we should say. And then the other thing that makes desire arise is the circumstance, which means we're near an object that sparks attachment to us, in us, okay? So you're near somebody who's attractive to you. You're near good food. You're near your baseball bat or golf clubs or running shoes. You're near your computer. You're near your, the chance to get a promotion and get a new title, whatever it is, okay? You're near something. And so that kind of sparks the attachment to arise in your mind. So of these two, the principal cause and then the cooperative condition of the object, the attachment that arises principally due, you know, or that arises due to the object is relatively easy to do away with compared to the root cause of the attachment, which is the latency or the seed of attachment in our mind. Because when it's the circumstance, yeah, you go to the beach and the beach makes attachment arise in your mind, and you know that, then to do away with the attachment, you don't go to the beach, or you leave the beach, or you, you know, instead of, you know, going to the ice cream store, or the wherever it is where the food is that you get attached to, you don't go there, okay? So you create a space or a distance between you and your object of attachment. So that becomes very helpful for subduing attachment. And that's one of the ways that monastic life functions, you know, because due to our precepts, we don't do a lot of things that most people that would the activities that would spark attachment in ordinary people. So we don't do those things. So it gives some space in the mind, and that attachment doesn't arise, you know, due to the circumstances. Then, because we have that space in our mind without having, you know, that manifest attachment, then we start looking into, okay, well, the attachment's coming because I, you know, have the seed of attachment in my mind. And that's arising because of grasping at true existence. So I really need to do the meditation on emptiness to get rid of this grasping at true existence. Okay, so you see how that works? It's not that you're escaping things by not being near the objects of your attachment, but you're creating space so that you have the mental space to really look and say, well, why do I get so attached to all these things? And how, you know, what's really making my attachment arise? How is this operating in my mind? And what's the effect when I have attachment? How do I become blind? Yeah, because when we're blind, you know, we may be attached to a person, we may be attached to a philosophy or an ideology. You know, you get, you see people getting attached to their religion and then, you know, doing all sorts of things in the name of their religion. Okay, so you try and see those things and how they work in your mind and how there's this desire to, you know, I want to grab onto things to make us happy and give us some sense of security. So we really, you know, go deep and look in our mind and try and see how all that works. Okay, and then undo it. Okay, so he says, desire arising through circumstances is like a bird not being able to fly without one of its wings, you know, whereas the kind of desire that's difficult to counteract is like a pigeon's instinctive desire. Okay, so, you know, if a bird has a broken wing, it can be fixed. So if our attachment arises because we're near someone or something that we're attached to, then that's easy. You fix the broken wing, you keep some distance from what's causing your attachment. What's difficult is the pigeon's instinctive desire, like our instinctive desire holding on to something, and that whole tendency in our life. Okay, so that takes much more difficult to get rid of. Okay, then verse 134 is how to abandon hatred or anger. So the verse reads, anger is lasting and certainly makes one do grave non-virtue. Thus, constant awareness of their distinctions will bring an end to afflictions. Okay, so anger is lasting and certainly makes one do grave non-virtue. Okay, so anger is more harmful than desire and attachment because anger destroys our merit. Okay, when we get angry, we are impeding our merit from ripening. We're impeding our good karma from bringing its results. So it's in that way that we say anger is more harmful or more graver than desire. Okay, and so for that reason, we should try and counteract our anger. Anger can some of our anger kind of arises quickly and goes away. Some of our anger lasts and is held forth and is held fast by resentment. Okay, so the anger that doesn't go away quickly becomes resentment. Resentment being a wish to harm or to respond to harm that involves holding on to anger. So resentment, we're holding on to something. It's not just, oh, somebody did this to me and I'm irritated and I say something and forget it. It's like, they did this to me and that's not right. This is not going to continue. I'm holding it. And so we can hold anger for years and decades in our life, you know. And you see this happening. Somebody did something to me, and I remain angry at that person for years and years and years. Or somebody did something to me, and I'm angry at that person. And then every time I see somebody who is in some way similar to that person, I get angry at that person, even though that person didn't do anything to me. Yeah? Like we had the thing here at the Abbey where there was one young man who came and somebody said, "Oh, you remind me of my brother." And even though the young man wasn't her brother, it was like, "Well, you're going to do the same thing to me that my brother did when we were kids." And, you know, and so you get involved in that kind of thing. So that's resentment. Yeah, it's resentment. It's grudge holding. Yeah. So that serves as a basis for non-fortitude or non-patience. And so remember when we were going through the mental factors, the non-whatever it is, doesn't just mean the lack of that, it means the opposite of that. Okay? So non-fortitude or non-patience means you're touchy, you're irascible, you're easily offended. Okay? Anybody have those traits? Huh? Somebody does something small, we like, you know, the anger comes quickly, and, you know, because there's just like these underneath long-term resentment or grudge holding, okay? So anger burns in our own and others' mind streams, and it makes us do harmful actions, doesn't it? Yeah. And so it's really, you know, when somebody holds on to something, our anger really becomes our own worst enemy. You know, we think I'm going to hold on to it because my anger is going to protect me. But it doesn't. It just brings more problems. Okay. I had two recent things that really reminded me of this. One was, you know, when one of the inmates who wrote me, and he had just gone through a period where he was just completely burning with anger. You know, just anything anybody did, he was so, you know, was so mad and so irascible. And he wrote me and he said one day he was standing there and there were some guards there and there was a fire extinguisher and he thought, you know, I could take that and, like, kill those guys. And luckily he held off, you know. And he realized he had a problem and I wrote him a really strong letter and I said, you know, you have to start letting go of this. Yeah, because he was so angry because the parole board, when he met with them, they said they were going to let him out in a short period of time. But when the determination actually came, it was for a much longer period of time. So he felt really angry that they had cheated him. And he wanted to go to his little sister's high school graduation. And I said, you know, if you let that kind of anger burn in you and you take it out on the people around you, instead of you going to her graduation, she's going to have to go to your murder trial. So I said, think about it. You know, what are you going to do? In the same way, sometimes people who are victims of crimes or the family of victims, oh, they are so upset at the person who committed the crime. And it just happened recently that there was, it's happened a couple of times actually, because I have on the website the section with the inmates' writings. And so sometimes people will catch a writing by a particular inmate who was in the news for one reason or another, and then they'll write me and they'll say, "How dare you have this person's writing on your website? You're giving them, you know, this person is scum, and how can you give them a platform to say anything?" Yeah. And so I have to, you know, write and respond and say, well, you know, I don't think anybody's inherently evil, and, you know, and I think people, you know, we do have good qualities. I try to nurture their good qualities. But you can see that some people, if they've been harmed, if they're a victim of a crime or a family member, it's so difficult for them to see anything good about the perpetrator of the crime, you know. All they see, they just hear the name and they're like, you know, tense and upset. Okay? So that's due to, you know, holding on to resentment. And that kind of resentment is due to pain. You know, because why do we often get angry? Because we're unhappy. Because we've experienced pain. And so that's how anger cheats us, because, you know, when we're unhappy, we think anger is going to protect us from the unhappiness. Or, you know, so that if I'm angry and I have this kind of energy, nobody can come hurt me again. Or when we experience pain, we feel like very powerless to change the situation. And so we get angry because anger gives us some kind of false feeling of power. So it really cheats us. Yeah, really, really cheats us. And, and so it makes us do all sorts of non-virtues, including even the five heinous actions. Okay? So it's very important. Here Gyaltsev says, through constant awareness of the faults of afflictions, okay, the disadvantages of afflictions, the causes and conditions of the afflictions, and the means to eliminate them. By really being aware of those, then we can bring afflictions to an end. Okay. So it really means, you know, that we should spend some time examining our lives and in our meditation, and what having an awareness of the fault of, you know, in this verse it's talking about anger, but it could be attachment, it could be ignorance. Really meditate, well, what's the fault of having this defilement? What's the disadvantage of it? What does it make me do? Okay. What causes it? What kind of situations does it arise in? And what about this underlying cause, the seat of the affliction? And what is the mean, how do I eliminate it? What is the temporary antidote to apply to that affliction? And then what is the long-term one, you know, the wisdom realizing emptiness? Okay? And so by doing that repeatedly, then we can start to really free ourselves of these afflictions. So there was a story in the book, okay? There was somebody named, okay, the Buddha, you know, the continuity of the person who became Shakyamuni Buddha, in a previous life was an ascetic called Sumedha, okay? And Sumedha lived at the time of the Buddha Dipamkara, and when he heard Buddha Dipamkara was coming to the town, he got filled with inspiration. You know, and he went to hear the teaching. And then later, the Buddha and his entourage were walking, and they were coming through an area that was very muddy, and Sumedha just lay down in the mud, and he was a Madhatera ascetic. He put his hair out, and he just said, please walk on top of me to cross over the mud. So Dharmaruchi saw this. The Buddha Dipamkara was at this point made a prediction to Sumedha about when he would attain enlightenment, you know, in the form of Shakyamuni Buddha and all. So Dharmaruchi saw this and he was furious. And he said, he's like an animal standing on the hare with both feet. Whoa, not good to say about a Buddha, you know? Okay, so this caused Dharmaruchi himself to be born as an animal 91 times. And one time, as a fish, he wrecked a boat, yeah, and, like, damaged the boat. And then he heard maybe a sailor or somebody call out the name Shakyamuni Buddha. And at that time, the fish thought, why should I continue in an animal's body? And so his life as the fish ended.
He was reborn as a human, and he became a monk, and through generating great aversion to cyclic existence, he became an arhat. Okay? So it's really showing, first of all, you can create big negative karma by getting angry, if you're angry at a Buddha and insulting a Buddha. But the other point of it is, you know, if you see your fault and you purify it and you change your ways, you can generate realizations and attain, you know, arhatship or full awakening. Okay? Okay. Then the next verse is talking about recognizing the root of afflictions. So this verse that I'm about to read is a very, very famous verse. You find it quoted many, many times in the teachings. Okay? It's kind of neat, as, you know, going through this. When I first studied this text many, many years ago, I didn't know very much and, you know, learned it. And now going through it, and I was like, I've heard that one is quoted. Jay Rinpoche quotes it. You know, Chandrakirti quotes it. You find all these verses that you're quite familiar with because people quote them all the time. Okay. So 135, as the tactile sense pervades the body, confusion is present in them all. By overcoming confusion, one will also overcome all afflictions. Okay. So this verse is in response to a question asked by Joe Blow when he said, we've discussed anger and desire, but what's the characteristics of confusion or ignorance? So here, confusion is is the translation for the Tibetan word timug, and ignorance is the translation for the Tibetan word marigpa. Okay, marigpa, M-A-R-I-G-P-A, and then timug, T-I-M-U-G. Okay? So in many instances, confusion and ignorance are synonymous. Okay? And this is in one of those instances. Okay? So the tactile sense organ, remember we have the six sense, we have the five sense organs plus the mental sense organ. So the tactile sense organ is the one that feels, you know, things. Okay? So the tactile sense organ pervades all the other areas where the other sense organs are. Okay? So not only, you know, where you have your retina and your, you know, your eye sense organ, you also have the tactile sense organ where you have the drum, what is it, the
anvil and
stirrup, you also have the tactile one. In your nose, you also have the tactile. In your tongue, you have the tactile. Okay? So this tactile pervades the areas where all the other sense organs are. Okay? So in the same way, you know, because, and if the tactile sense organ weren't there, then the other sense organs wouldn't be functioning either, you know, because something would be really wrong with the body. So confusion here, which here means the affliction of ignorance, it misconceives dependent arisings which are free from inherent existence to be inherently existent. Okay? So things that are dependent arising, you, me, the car, the prayer flags, whatever, these things arise due to dependence on other factors. So they're dependent arisings that are free from inherent existence. They don't have their own independent essence, their own inherent nature. Confusion perceives these things which are dependent and free of inherent existence as existing from their own side, independently existent, inherently existent, truly existent, existing by their own nature. There's a lot of words that, according to the Prasangikas, mean the same thing. Okay? So confusion misperceives things in that way. And it is present and pervades all the afflictions. Okay? So, yeah, misconceiving things that are distorted by confusion and thinking that they are inherently existent, or thinking that they're inherently pleasant or inherently unpleasant, okay, then we think of these things as desirable or repugnant. Yeah, you with me? Yeah. And so then, you know, desirable, I want, repugnant, I get angry and push away. Okay? So he's saying it's very important to understand the mode of apprehension entailed in grasping in true existence, and understand that that mode of apprehension is present in the mode of apprehension of desire and anger, okay? In the sense that when we have desire, the mind is grasping at the object as being inherently attractive or inherently pleasurable. When we're angry, yeah, confusion, ignorance is grasping at the object as being inherently undesirable, inherently unattractive. Okay? So it's saying that, you know, together with the desire and the anger, you have confusion there too, just as, well, you have your eye sense organ and your ear sense organ and these sense, you also have the tactile sense organ. Okay, so that's what it's saying. Yeah. So all the other afflictions depend on the affliction of ignorance, okay, which is the principal one. So remember when we talk about the 12 links of dependent arising, the first link is ignorance, the second link is volitional action. So by the first link, ignorance, then we generate some affliction. That affliction makes us act, and that becomes the second link, and then that leaves a karmic imprint on the consciousness, and then so on. You have the rest of the 12 links progressing, okay? So by overcoming confusion, by meditation on dependent arising, okay, and seeing that dependent arisings are empty of inherent existence, then you can overcome all the other afflictions, because ignorance supports all the other afflictions. It's right there. Okay. Therefore, we should make an effort to understand emptiness as the meaning of dependent arising. Do you remember that phrase from Jeffrey? Emptiness as the meaning of dependent arising, and dependent arising as the meaning of emptiness? Yeah, remember that? Okay, and so when we remove the root, you know, which is ignorance, then everything that's supported by the root, the desire, the anger, the jealousy, all these other things, those all things all die. In the same way that if you get your knapweed by the root, then that knapweed branches and seeds and blossoms, everything's finished. Okay? So this kind of afflictive ignorance that we have here is not merely the absence of knowledge, and it's not merely an unknowing or a not knowing. Okay? But there's two principal forms of ignorance. So one of them actively misapprehends how things exist. It's not just a not knowing. It actively misapprehends. Yeah, so it actively thinks things exist in the opposite way from the how they do exist. And then the other kind of ignorance or confusion is with respect to karma and its effects. And so respect to causality, not seeing that what we experience in life depends on our actions. Okay? So one is the first ignorance was with respect to the fundamental nature of reality. The ignorance regarding karma and its effects is with respect to the conventional nature, the conventional functioning of things. Now, having said this, explained this verse in this way, there's a lot of discussion about this verse. Okay, a lot of discussion. Okay, because some people say you have the grasping and inherent existence. That leads to the grasping at a self-sufficient, substantially existent person, and that leads to gross attachment and gross anger. But those three mental factors, the ignorance, the grasping at self-sufficient, substantial existence, and then the affliction, desire, or hatred, have three different modes of apprehension. Some, you know, one way of explaining it. So ignorance apprehends things as true existence. Based on that, then you have another kind of ignorance that apprehends things as self-sufficient, substantially existent. Based on that, then you generate gross afflictions. Okay? So those things, in, you know, I've talked to some Geshe's, when I push them, they say things, they never want this on the record, so this is not supposed to be on the record, but this is kind of some private talk. They'll say, you know, it's three different moments. It's the ignorance, grasping true existence leads to the ignorance, grasping self-sufficient, substantially existent leads to the arisal of the desire. And that those three mental factors each apprehend their object in a different way. So because of that, they don't occur simultaneously. So the way His Holiness explains it is that he brings this into the discussion of the difference between the lower schools and the Prasangika. Okay? Because all the lower schools, when they talk about the mental factor that keeps you bound in cyclic existence, it's grasping at the self-sufficient, substantially existent person. The Prasangika say that it's grasping at an inherently existent or truly existent person. Okay? So there, all the other schools, including the Svatantrika Madhyamaka, the way they talk about the selflessness of person that is the chief thing that keeps you bound in samsara is very different than the way the Prasangikas talk about it. You know, that first link, what keeps you bound, first link ignorance, what keeps you bound in samsara. So His Holiness says that that indicates a gross and subtle afflictions. Mm-hmm. So the afflictions that arise due to grasping at a self-sufficient, substantially existent person are gross compared to the afflictions that arise due to grasping at an inherently existent person. So the afflictions arising from grasping a self-substantially existent person, everybody recognizes as afflictions. But the afflictions that are subtle, that arise from grasping at a truly existent person, are more subtle, and the lower schools don't recognize those as afflictions because they don't recognize grasping as inherent existence as an affliction. Okay?
Do they recognize them as?
They don't even recognize it. They don't even talk about it. Mm-hmm. Okay? In terms of being the first link ignorance.
Okay?
Yeah, they don't talk about it. In the Svatantrika Madhyamaka, it might come in talking about the selflessness of phenomena, but, you know, certainly not in terms of what the root of samsara is. Okay? So, you know, but when you think of this, it's got to be like, you know, when you have gross, gross desire, the subtle desire's got to be there at the same time.
Right.
you know, underneath that somehow. So the subtle one, His Holiness is saying, is that there the grasping at true existence is together with the desire. It's like the tactile sense pervading the other sense. Because that desire is grasping at the attractiveness or the pleasantness of the object as being inherently existent. Okay? So that's a little bit different than grasping at a self-sufficient, substantially existent person, and then having desire. Yeah, because that gross desire isn't grasping at its object as being inherently pleasurable or inherently unpleasant. Okay. But when you look at it, you try and identify these things in your mind, it gets very difficult.
Very subtle.
Yeah, especially because we can't tell the difference between normal and grasping and self-sufficient substantially existent. We can't even recognize that one, let alone grasping and inherently existent. Okay. But there's a lot of discussion about this verse and what it really means in gross and subtle afflictions and how that ties into the selflessness of person asserted by the different schools and so on. So I thought I would just bring that in.
Can I ask about that? So first of all, let me check this, because I thought I had gotten clear that the first linked ignorance was the view of the transitory collection.
The view of the transitory collection, okay, jitta, according to the Prasangikas, is a type of ignorance. It is ignorance.
And is it the coarse ignorance that's grasping at the self-sufficient system?
According to the Prasangikas, it's the subtle ignorance.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because remember, according to the Prasangikas, you need to realize the emptiness of true existence to get out of samsara.
Right.
Okay, so that jigta is a subtle ignorance.
Okay, that is grasping at true existence. That's its object.
Yeah. But it's specifically grasping at the true existence of your own self. Okay?
Yeah.
Yeah. Of course, it arises dependent on grasping at the true existence of your aggregates. So all these things kind of, they're related. Yeah. So even though they identify jigta as the first link ignorance, it doesn't mean that grasping at the true existence of phenomena isn't the first link in ignorance. Okay.
Well, yeah. Just to clarify, so when you were talking about His Holiness's position, so he's saying that the grasping at true existence arises together with the gross desire.
No, he's saying the gross desire, by itself, also grasps at true existence. The subtle desire by itself grasps at true existence.
Okay, so, and that's different from the distinction of the three modes of apprehension?
Yeah, because the ones who say they're different, first you grasp something as inherently existent. Then you grasp yourself as inherent. Then you grasp yourself as self-substantially existent. Then you generate desire. Okay. But
With an object.
Desire always has to have an object.
Right, and so what he's saying at the subtle level, the object is the desirability.
What he's saying is that the desire, by its, you know, incorporated in the desire is also grasping at the true existence. The other way doesn't say the desire is grasping at true existence or grasping at it at self-sufficient substantial existence. It's just arising as another step in that chain. But this one is the desire itself contains an element of self-grasping. Yeah. Well, they say it contains an element of self-grasping.
It's
That might, you know. They're not, you know, it's not. Yeah, so.
And what are the implications of this debate?
The implications are, unless you're able to identify the grasping at true existence in your own mind and counteract it, you can eliminate the gross levels of desire and not get yourself out of cyclic existence. So this difference, you know, in terms of what is the root of cyclic existence is very, very important. Yeah. And that's where the prasangikas are continually going and saying, you know, if you don't realize this emptiness, you can realize what you say the self the self of persons is, but you won't get out of samsara by realizing that. Yeah. So many things when you learn the tenets, it's depending on the object of negation. Yeah, what it is you're saying doesn't exist, or what it is you're saying ignorance holds. Yeah. So much of the difference in the tenet systems is based on that. Yeah. And so the prasangikas keep coming back to it because they're really trying to get it in your noggin, you know. Kind of. Don't just negate some gross selflessness. Go for the deep one. Of course, like I said, you know, we can't even tell any of them when they're active in our mind.
And then where I get confused, too, is that on a practical level, if indeed, as the prasangikas say, no matter what their tenet is, every arhat has realized exactly this,
right?
Then it's. I mean, my mind goes, well, if you've gotten to the point where you actually have realized the emptiness of the self-sufficient, substantially existent person, then you're well on the way.
Yeah, it's a big step. You're well on the way. But if you've never heard there's something deeper than that to look for, you'll never look for it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But then, when they say that arhats and bodhisattvas realize the same emptiness.
Mm-hmm. The Arya bodhisattvas on path of seeing, and the hearers and solitary realizers on their path of seeing, they've both realized the same emptiness. Even though in the tenet systems it says they've realized different things. According to the prasangika, the way the prasangika talk about it, they realize the same thing. Because the prasangika defines the self of persons and self of phenomena differently than the lower schools do. All the schools have their own ways of defining these things. And some schools don't even talk about the self of phenomena. Okay, so they define these things differently. Okay.
And what can I ask a question about anger? Go back a little bit. It's a little bit of confusion I have about the 10 pathways of negative action, 10 negative pathways of action. So that we don't, so that in that, if I think from that list of 10, the anger in your mind doesn't become like a destructive action until it becomes ill will, until it's really fomented and...
Yes.
So when we turn around and look at our the chapters on fortitude and patience, and we hear, you know, a moment of anger destroys 100 years of whatever.
Yeah.
If you don't open your mouth, you know, if you don't, that doesn't propel you. Is it so that the anger can come and go and come and go, but it's the fermentation that builds up speed in your mind or that builds up momentum in your mind if you don't do an action with that anger, that that's what's destructive? Do you understand what I'm saying? So if I look at the 10 destructive actions, ill will is not just a moment of anger.
Right.
Ill will is an accumulation of thoughts.
Right.
And that will propel you to a physical or verbal action.
Yes, it could. It doesn't have to. We can sit and meditate with ill will for a few hours and not say or do anything.
Right, and then you're creating big negative karma.
Yeah,
but a flash of anger that comes in.
Okay. So,
okay, we mine are never that fast.
Yeah.
But
they talk about a moment of anger, you know, destroys this many. This is always a topic. When we come to that in Gopuravsal, there's always so many questions. And what they say in there and what they say in other teachings, you sometimes get very different answers.
And the debate, the debate is long.
Yeah, but it seems like in Gomparapsa, what they're really talking about there is anger at a bodhisattva.
Yeah.
And moment of anger doesn't just mean boop, boop. Moment, because you ask, what is a moment?
Right.
It's a period of time. How long is that period of time? Well, it depends on the situation. A moment just means a period of time. Sometimes it's 1/65th of this. Sometimes it's moment means something that's longer. But it's a moment. Okay? So I don't think it's necessarily like just a blip of anger, you know, but there's something, a moment.
Can it be half a day?
Can it be what?
Half a day?
I don't know. It doesn't define what a moment is. But, you know, to me it seems like to destroy, you know, your marriage. There's got to be some, you know,
consistency.
Yeah, you know, I mean, it's got not a half a day or not an hour, but, you know, there's something. It's not just a blip. That's my personal opinion, so don't listen to it. Okay. Yes?
John has a related question.
Okay.
So he says, if I'm sitting here daydreaming about my day off coming up, and there appears to be an uninterrupted continuity of desire, are the Geshe's saying that there's really a moment of grasping inherent existence, then grasping the self-sufficiently existent person, and then desire, then repeat?
No. If you have a whole, like, uniform of desire, you know, you're dreaming about your day off, you just have the inherent existence, the grasping inherent existence, grasping as self-sufficient existence. Then you have the desire, and the desire just keeps. I think that's the way they would answer that. You know, I don't think you have to keep going and starting over at the beginning. I think it just does that. You know, maybe if your desire starts to get a little weak, then you perk it up with some more grasping. Okay. Good. I mean, these are very interesting topics, but I've always found that when you start poking and asking a lot of questions, it's, you know, there's a lot of debate and a lot of different things, and you can't get some nice, neat, clean, clear thing, you know, because you can look at it this way, you can look at it this way, you know, and nobody wants it to be on the record written down. It's talked about in debate and discussed, so I just shared some of those things. Okay?
May the spiritual teachers who lead me on the sacred path, and all spiritual friends who practice it, have long life. May I pacify completely all outer and inner hindrances. Grant such inspiration, I pray. May the lives of the venerable spiritual mentors be stable, and their virtuous actions spread in the 10 directions. May the light of Lobsang's teachings dispelling the darkness of the beings in the three worlds always in.
Dham Guru Ratna Mandala Kamnirya Tayami.
Due to this merit,
may we soon attain the awakened state of Guru Buddha, that we may be able to liberate all sentient beings from their suffering. May the precious Bodhi mind, not yet born, arise and grow. May that born have no decline, but increase forevermore. In the snowy mountain pure land, you're the source of good and happiness. Our full Tenzin Gyatso Chenrezi, may you stay until samsara ends.
May the deeds
of explaining and practicing the Dharma, done by groups supporting the teachings and their upholders, who spread the view of dependent arising and nonviolent actions in the 10 directions, and especially at Shravasti Abbey in the West,